You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In April 1989, a jogger was brutally attacked and raped in Central Park, a crime that stunned the city and the nation. Five teenage boys were arrested, interrogated, coerced into giving confessions, and then convicted of committing the crime, despite a lack of evidence other than those false confessions. In 2001, after the five had served long sentences, the real rapist came forward and confessed. A new documentary about the case called The Central Park Five was produced, written, and directed by Sarah Burns and David McMahon, along with award-winning filmmaker Ken Burns. Sarah and David join us now, and in a few minutes, we expect to be joined as well by Raymond Santana, one of the Central Park Five. The film is now playing at the IFC Center and will be available on demand beginning December 7th. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having us.
David, as your film points out, this all took place during a time when violent crime in the city was high and when racial tensions were quite high. As Jim Dwyer of the New York Times points out in the film, in 1989, there were about six murders a day in New York. Why did the Central Park jogger case stand out so much and get so much attention?
Yeah, I think homicides were peaking. By 1989, there were something over 2,000. I think it got attention because it was black-on-white crime, and it was in a sacred place, Central Park, a place where there was less crime than people were led to believe, but so when something happened there, it really stood out. And so it garnered a lot of attention, and I think it got a lot of attention because we were in the midst of the tabloid wars, and newspapers were competing with each other to grab as many viewers as possible, and so they splashed sensational headlines all over and were trying to sell as many papers as they could.
But there were, Sarah, groups of roving teens that scared people all over the city, and especially in Central Park. How many kids were out in the park that night?
Yeah, in that group there were maybe as many as 30 teenagers who had gone into the park that night, that the Central Park Five were a part of this sort of loose-knit group. And there certainly had been complaints about other incidents sort of like this in other situations before that. And so there was a sense that these kids they sort of represented what people feared in the city at that time.
And that's why there was less of an outcry from the African-American and Hispanic communities, because many people in those communities also feared some of these kids who were engaged in what came to be known as wilding.
Yeah, I mean, Calvin Butts says that in our film, that people in the minority communities were also sort of terrified in the same way that whites were in the city. But I also think that there is a sort of exaggerated sense that our social problems were this result of minority teenagers, when in fact that wasn't exactly the case. It wasn't the whole story, certainly.
We're waiting for Raymond to show up. He's going to be coming here during his lunch hour. So there are certain questions I want to ask him specifically about what he was doing in the park that day and why, and whether he was part of the group that was causing all the trouble. But why were these five, since there were so many kids in the park, why were they singled out?
I think in some ways they were the most vulnerable. Some of the other kids in the group had maybe been in trouble and had been in and out of the system, and their parents were sort of aware of how to handle these situations. And so, you know, they knew what to say in the face of these seasoned detectives who were interrogating them. The five hadn't been in any trouble with the law, and their families hadn't been involved with the system. And so they didn't necessarily know how to handle this. And so when the interrogators told them, you know, if you tell us what you want to hear, you'll get to go home, they were, you know, eager to please. And so they could get themselves out of the situation.
Were any of the boys' parents present during the police questioning?
In some cases, they were. The requirement was that anyone under 16 was supposed to have a guardian present for questioning. None of them had lawyers, and in some cases, they did have guardians. But the police were pretty good at keeping the guardians in the dark about what the real situation was. And also, these guys all talk about these situations where they're pulled out of the room and the detectives are talking to them outside while the interrogation continues. Or, you know, Raymond Santana's grandmother was there, who doesn't speak a lot of English, and they weren't translating for her. So they were prevented from being very effective.
And you say there are no lawyers. Are they required to have legal representation? When we're talking about kids who were 14, 15, and 16 years old.
Right, and I think that, I mean, they were read their Miranda rights, but so they were told that they could have a lawyer. But I don't think that the way those rights are presented necessarily is clear, and I don't think they completely understood those rights. And so none of them asked for a lawyer, and no lawyers were present until after the statements were made.
The entire case was based on confessions. What did the boys say that led them to confess to crimes that they didn't commit?
Well, they, you know, what happens in that interrogation room is such an extreme situation. And the power differential is really extraordinary. And so you have these seasoned detectives and these children who are naive about the system. And they were under a huge amount of pressure.
And the kids describe having one detective really in their face, blowing cigarette smoke into their faces, another one yelling into their ear. And then a third one comes in playing the good cop, bad cop, good cop. He says, listen, if you just go along with some of the things that we're asking you to say, you can go home tonight.
After hours of back and forth and using this technique that you just described, plus no food, no sleep, you know, fear mounting, and then ultimately a sense that if they just said what it was that the detectives wanted to hear, then they would get to go home and they would get some relief. This would stop. It would be over.
And we are now joined by Raymond Santana, one of the Central Park Five. Hi, Raymond.
How are you doing?
So why were you in the park that night?
Well, basically just hanging out with friends. It was a school night, but we was off the next night. So basically just being a follower, hanging out with friends and following the crowd.
And your father had suggested that you go to the park because you were hanging around the house or the neighborhood. And he expresses terrible guilt later that he had set you into this terrible situation.
Yeah, that was always his thing. His thing was always, you know, you don't need to hang on the corner. You don't need to hang around the neighborhood. The neighborhood's pretty bad. You can do stuff like go to the park, library, you know, go pack bags at the supermarket was one of his things. You know, he always implemented for me to do. And, he had a rough time, definitely.
Now, the crowd of teenagers you were with was making some trouble. What were they doing?
Well, several of them were charged with robbery charges and assault charges, which they later copped out to. You know, they took plea bargains.
And they were throwing rocks? They were hurting people?
Yes, throwing rocks at cars and stuff like that.
What about you?
No, I didn't partake in any of that.
How old were you at the time?
I was 14 years old at the time. Wow. And, you know, when you're that age, you know, and to see, you know, older individuals doing stuff, you know, it takes you back a little bit. And you also become afraid to partake in stuff like that. So, you know, I stood towards the back of the group.
Well, the entire case against you and the four other boys was based on your confessions. We've talked a bit about how confessions are coerced, but what was your experience? Why did you confess to a crime that you didn't commit?
Well, it was due to a lot of pressure. You know, you walk into a situation that's unknown. You know, you've never been, I was never charged, you know, I was never arrested before, never had any real dealings with the police. And so this was a situation that I walked into that I was unfamiliar with. A lot of pressure. Automatically, you become scared. You don't know what's going to happen to you. You look for your parents to guide you because those are your protectors at that point. And they weren't there. So you're all alone. And, you know, the detectives, they start off, but, you know, just tell us what happened. And then, you know, as time goes on, they become very aggressive.
Well, did you even know that a rape had been committed before you were taken into custody?
No. They had no idea of that.
So how did you wind up telling a story about rape? They were pretty much putting words into your mouth?
Yeah, definitely. And also leading me on. And there was that promise of that I would be able to go home. And so, you know, that's the ultimate, you know. And then there was also, you know, Hardigan will always, you know, he leaded with a lot of, you know, Raymond, I just need you to help me out.
He was the good cop. Two guys were being tough on you. And then he was the cop who said, I need your help.
Yeah.
And you can go home after that.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, David, were the accounts of the crime that the boys gave in their confessions consistent? Did they include actual details of the crime?
They included details, but none of them matched with what the others were saying. And so they described what she was wearing in different ways. They described the location of the crime. Raymond said it was by the reservoir quarry, and one of his confessions says it was in one place, and another one of his confessions says it was another place. There's nothing consistent about them at all.
And none of the boys implicated themselves. They only admitted to seeing others committing the crime. So did that make them feel like they would be safe?
Right. I think they believed that they would be witnesses, and that was the way the police had presented this to them, that this, that giving the statement was a way out. They could be a witness, they could help out, and they could go home.
Raymond, how long were you questioned in the precinct house?
You know, I was told it was over 15 hours. To this day, I still don't have no I can't tell you how long I was in there. It just felt like it was forever.
Now, there are videotapes of the confessions by four of the boys, not all five. Why not the fifth?
Yusuf Salam, who was 15 years old, was initially interrogated without a guardian present, though that wasn't wasn't following the requirements. The police said that they believed he was 16. And so when his mother did arrive at the precinct, she made them stop, and that was before he had signed a statement. But the judge allowed into evidence the sort of typed report of the detective, and it was presented essentially as if it had been a written confession.
Now, Raymond, your father was with you in the room during your videotape confession.
Yes.
Which is different. First, they got you to write a written confession, and yeah, then a videotape confession.
Yeah. What happened was during the writing of the second statement, he objected and he spoke, and Michael Sheen, who was a detective, came down so hard on my dad, you know, that and my father, you know, never had any record, you know, with the law and never been involved with the justice system. And so my dad kind of froze up and didn't know what to do.
What did the police tell you at the time about what the video was for and how it would be used?
Well, you know, by that time, once I was broken down and you know, he fed me what he thought was the facts, and I put together a story. And, you know, he told me, he said, look, you know, you did a great thing for me. You know, I'll make sure you go home. Everything's going to be all right, but I need you to do one more thing. And so, you know, it was, you know, he proposed. He said, look, just do this next statement. You're going to go with this next detective. You're going to tell him the same story you told me. And then after that, you're going to do a video. Do that and don't worry about it.
Now, Yusuf Salam, the boy wasn't videotaped, still was convicted. I guess he wasn't videotaped because his mother intervened. But so he was just convicted on the basis of the written statement, the sworn statement?
He didn't even sign a written statement, but the notes that the detective had taken became a kind of report that was admitted by the judge. And I think that there was a sense of sort of guilt by association. He was tried along with two of the other defendants, and so they were all sort of lumped together in the same way they were in the media. This was like this wolf pack, and so the sense that his was a different situation was lost.
Were the five of you friends, Raymond?
No, we weren't.
So did you know all five of them?
I didn't know any of them.
When did you realize that this was something very serious?
When I reached the detention center, because the counselor came downstairs and the counselor explained to us how serious how serious this case was, and the seriousness of how the inmates they vowed to do some type of harm to us.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't going home. You realized that.
Yeah, you realized that.
Although a couple of the kids did go home because their families were able to make bail.
Yes.
What about you?
No, I wasn't able to make bail.
So suddenly you found yourself in jail for
17
simply
months.
Because you had been in the park.
Yes.
My guests are Raymond Santana, one of the Central Park Five, and the subject of a new film called The Central Park Five, which was produced, written, and directed by Sarah Burns, David McMahon, and Ken Burns. It is currently at the IFC Center, and you can also see it on demand beginning the 7th, which is just a couple of days from now. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Sarah Burns, David McMahon, two of the three filmmakers, along with Ken Burns, responsible for a new film called The Central Park Five. Also with us is Raymond Santana, one of the Central Park Five. The film is now playing at the IFC Center and the Lincoln Plaza. It's also in various locations around the metropolitan area. The media coverage was a major part of this story, and Wilding was used. Wolf pack was another word that was used a lot. Looking at the coverage now, are you surprised by all the racial codes that were used and by the rush to judgment by all the newspapers?
I was initially when I first looked at this case, and it's actually what I first studied about. I wrote my undergraduate thesis about the media coverage. But it really stunned me the degree of racism that you were seeing. And this is, I'm thinking, this is 1989 in New York City, and it's the language of lynching. It's the language of the Scottsboro Boys case. And we'd like to think that that is in the past, and we see it here and realize that it hasn't changed that much.
People are calling for the death penalty. What was Mayor Koch saying?
Well, Mayor Koch, I don't think, was particularly involved in the day-to-day sort of investigation and pursuit of more information about the case. But he was out there in the public, as always, and so he was getting asked questions. And I think his reaction best represents the reaction of the city, which was, this is a heinous crime, and people need to be brought to justice immediately, especially at the end of a decade that had so many racially charged crimes.
Jim Dwyer points out that the police presented a chronology of the boys' attacks in the park, a timeline of events that included the attack on the jogger. But did the timeline match up with what we knew about the jogger's timeline?
It didn't. And the problem was that the jogger was in a coma for almost 2 weeks. I mean, she suffered a brutal attack and had a traumatic brain injury. And so it wasn't until she woke up that she was able to establish sort of when she'd entered the park. And it was at that time that their chronology sort of fell apart.
She's been a guest on the show, and she's talked about how she just lost a whole bunch of memory. And it's amazing how much she has recovered. It's an extraordinary medical story. There was a lack of any forensic evidence, DNA, fingerprints, footprints, clothing, threads. Why didn't that matter to the police and the prosecutors?
I think it speaks to the effect of a confession, in this case a false confession, that if somebody says they did something, it's very hard to understand why they would say that if they didn't actually do it. And so in the face of all this evidence, the confession still proved more powerful.
One of the five, Kevin, says that when they told him they found his fingerprints on her clothing, he wondered, they put my fingerprints on her clothing. We have a clip from the film that we'd like to play.
It is improbable, given the nature of this crime and the scene, that these boys would not have left a single trace of themselves on the scene, or the scene a single trace on them. The improbability of that is striking. But the decision was, we can still prosecute this case, and the argument we will make to the jury is, just because we didn't get all of them, doesn't mean we didn't get some of them. They now created a scenario by which there is a sixth perpetrator. A sixth perpetrator who mysteriously doesn't appear in any of the confessions. But even if they were correct, that sixth perpetrator's absence in their confessions makes the confessions factually incorrect. That should have been the dilemma.
Was anybody in the prosecuting team or in the police department asking those kinds of questions? Were people outside asking those kinds of questions?
Not that we know of. No one in the police and prosecutors' offices were asking those questions. Certainly they should have been.
Well, we did a segment on the show just last week about wrongful convictions, and the guest, a law professor named Daniel Medwood, talked about tunnel vision. That obviously applied in this case, didn't it?
It did. In fact, Ron Gold, the juror who we interview in the film, he, at the end of the trial, went into deliberations thinking that, you know, well, he saw lots of contradictions in these confessions, which were clearly the basis of the argument for their guilt. And when he got into deliberations, he was astonished to find that the other 11 jurors thought, this is open and shut. We can just move to convict right away. They had been so swayed by those confessions.
Raymond, were you aware of what was being reported on the case in the newspapers and television?
Just some of the newspapers, not too much of the television.
And what did you think about the way you were being portrayed?
I mean, you know, it's as a kid, it's hard to digest. You know, it's hard to process because here it is. You know, you see these drawings of you looking like you're a monster, and then all these labels that you're receiving. You know, and you don't know what to do. You don't know what to think. You know, it becomes like a numb process.
And when they photograph that perp walk, and your head is down or covered by your coat, that almost says guilty.
Yeah.
What was the trial like for you? Did you think that you'd be found innocent, that the truth would come out during the trial?
I really hope so. I hope that even before then, you know, that the truth will come out and that people will see the inconsistencies and the no DNA match and even like the chronology, like Sarah said. You know, we hope that all that stuff would bring questions and people will say, wait a minute, something's wrong here. But everybody just bypassed it.
Well, how effective were the defense attorneys?
for the most part, not very effective. I mean, I think one of the defense attorneys appears in our film, Michael Joseph, who represented Antron, and he, I think, did the best that he could under pretty impossible circumstances. I'm not sure that a great attorney could have gotten them off.
Did they argue that the confessions had been coerced?
They tried to.
Because those were the only real evidence that these boys might be guilty.
Right. And not only was there not forensic evidence, there were DNA tests that showed that did not match them. I mean, there was even forensic evidence proving they didn't do it that was ignored. And I think that was early enough in the technology of DNA testing that it was easier for the prosecution to sort of skim over that without really addressing what that meant.
But Raymond, at the trial, you saw yourself on video confessing. That was the main evidence against you.
Yeah. And looking at that video, you know, this is a 14-year-old kid who's telling facts that are incorrect, and you just hope that people would see that and people would point that out, and nobody did.
You, Antron, Kevin, Youssef were all sentenced as juveniles, and that was to the maximum 5 to 10 years in detention. Corey Wise was 16 years old and was sentenced as an adult to 5 to 15 years in maximum security prison. Did you see each other when you were in prison?
No, they sent us to different prisons.
And what was your time behind bars like? Did you get your GED?
Yes, I obtained my GED, and I was also able to do a couple of trades, and I went to college, and I received my associate's in college.
And how long were you in prison?
At that point, I was in prison 5 years.
You say at that point?
Yeah, because after that, when I reached my 21st birthday, I got transferred to an adult facility.
And then they let you out? And
yes, I got conditional release, and so altogether at that point, I did almost 7 years.
And then you were arrested again. Why?
Yeah.
What did you do?
Well, what happened was I received a parole violation, which they stated was a curfew violation. They gave me 2.5 years for that. And so they sent me back, and then I came back. And upon coming back, you know, I tried to do the right thing and get a job. And I still had to register as a sex offender. I had to attend sex offender classes. I had this parole officer who was constantly on my back. And again, you know, there was no transitional program for me to come home and help me transition properly. And so as a result, I broke down, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to turn, and I started selling drugs in the process.
Yeah. My guests are Raymond Santana, who was one of the Central Park Five, subject of a new film from Sarah Burns, David McMahon, and Ken Burns that is currently at the IFC Center and the Lincoln Plaza, and at various theaters around the area. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When and how, David, did Matias Reyes confess to the crime? Had he ever been a suspect?
Corey Wise was one of the five, was serving early at Rikers while he was on trial, and he bumped into Reyes there. 13 years later, they bumped into each other again at a prison upstate, and at that point, Reyes recognized Corey. He was aware that he was serving time still for a crime that Reyes had committed. He went and told the authorities of the prison, who brought the information down to Manhattan, and they started a reinvestigation. So 13
he had
years.
Gotten away with the crime. Why did he confess to it? Was he just feeling guilty, or was he in jail for so long that it didn't matter anymore?
Right. I mean, the statute of limitations was up, so he can never be tried for this crime. So it doesn't in that way affect him. And he said that he felt bad realizing that Corey, you know, was still in prison for this crime, and there was something he could do about it. And, you know, there's always something to gain from making a deal like that.
Had the cops collected DNA evidence? Were they doing that in rape cases at that time? So Reyes, I would have assumed that since Reyes was a serial rapist, that they would have found DNA evidence that would have connected the rapist to a bunch of crimes, including this.
There were investigators who were investigating both the jogger case and other crimes that Reyes had committed, and they had DNA markers in those files. I think today it's a more sophisticated database, but all they would have had to do is compare those samples, and they would have had a match.
Had he ever been a suspect in the crime?
Not that we know of. I mean, there was another rape on April 17th in Central Park, 2 days before the Central Park jogger rape, that we know was committed by Matias Reyes. And the police had, in investigating that, come up with his name at that time and still failed to make this connection. So, you know, when you think about that question of their idea in that clip that there was a sixth perpetrator, if they actually believed that and were looking for a sixth perpetrator, he should have been the first door they knocked on.
Raymond, how did you find out about Reyes's confession?
Well, I was serving a 3.5 to 7 year sentence, and I was in prison, and I called my dad, and he told me the news over the phone, and I was so institutionalized by that time I didn't even believe him, and I even hung up the phone on him because I thought he was lying or playing around, and then afterwards I wound up seeing this special that came on TV, and that was the first time I actually saw Reyes's face, and I got to hear his words say that he did it and he did it alone.
So were you released on the spot?
No, because the DA's office had to do a re-examination, and so that took about a year. And then after that, the convictions were vacated, and then I had to be resentenced.
Once you were released, did you make contact with the other four?
Yes, at our attorney's offices, you know, we got together, and I was able to see Kevin and Antron at that point, because he hadn't moved yet, and we wound up going out to have breakfast and you know, just reconnecting.
Antron refused to be shown on camera, although he does talk to you. Is that because he wants to start a new life?
Basically, he's also a very shy person, but he moved away from New York, and he lives a life that's very separate from this story where the people around him don't know it, and it's really just about maintaining his privacy.
Was having the conviction overturned satisfying enough to you? You lost 17 years of your life.
I mean, it wasn't satisfying, but it was a start. You know, it was finally a start for me to try to pick up my pieces and put my life back together.
But what happens if you are exonerated from a crime? You still have a prison record, don't you? You still have to explain to somebody when you're applying for a job where those 17 years went, don't you?
That's correct. You know, I had applied for a job a couple of years ago, and even though nothing came up on my prison record, somebody Googled me, and they found out who I was, and I didn't get the job as a result of that, even though I was exonerated.
Well, there wasn't as much media attention to the overturning of the verdict and the exoneration as there was to the trial in 1990. Do you think that the story of Reyes's confession and the wrongful convictions of the Central Park Five was overlooked because it wasn't as sensational?
Oh, definitely. And I think that it's also because some of the reporters and some of the publications remained invested in that original outcome. They had gotten it wrong and weren't willing to admit their culpability.
We have a clip from Jim Dwyer, the New York Times, about this.
I don't think the police department faced the truth of what had happened, because the truth of what had happened is almost unbearable. By prosecuting the wrong people for the Central Park jogger case, Mateus Reyes continued to hurt, maim, and kill. And they could have had him, but they got stuck with a mistake. And they're still invested in that mistake.
Nobody from the police department or the prosecution team was willing to appear in this film. Are they still arguing that they didn't make a mistake?
Yes. I mean, the official stance of the NYPD on this was a report that they commissioned around the time of this reinvestigation by the district attorney's office that basically found that in concluding that the police department had done nothing wrong, that the five therefore must have had something to do with this crime.
Aren't there people who still insist that the Central Park Five are guilty despite all the evidence and Mateus Reyes's confession?
Yes. I mean, some of these, the police and some of the prosecutors and some journalists, I think, too, who I think it's exactly what Jim Dwyer is talking about. It's people not willing to admit that they made this mistake.
Now, David, meanwhile, your film outtakes and notes have been subpoenaed. Why?
Well, I think on the surface they were subpoenaed by Corporation Counsel in the hopes that in combing through them they could find some contradictory statement by the five, something that they said where in some earlier hearing or deposition they gave a different answer to. And so they could use that, hold that against them in their credibility. I think they also did it in order to continue to delay the civil suit, which has been going on for almost a decade, and they've been using any tactic that they have to keep this thing out of the courts.
So what is the status of that suit against the prosecutors and the police?
Well, right now we're still in depositions, and you know, we don't know when the process of discovery is going to end. You know, they send you these waivers and they want you to fill out these waiver forms so that they can look through your history and look at your medical records and your prison records and your educational records. And for my dad, they went back 25 years and they looked at the hospitals and the doctors that he has seen. Has he ever been on disability? And they even went as far as like looking through our Facebook pages and stuff like that.
Now, as I mentioned, the police and prosecutors declined to participate in the documentary. How many times did you approach them? I would think that if they still think the Central Park Five are guilty, they would have been happy to participate.
Well, we approached them a number of times. I don't think we counted, but we talked to Corporation Counsel who represents them, and they also told us that we couldn't speak with them and some of the individuals as well. But I think that they mostly cited the civil suit as the reason why they couldn't or didn't want to talk because they're now defendants. But I also wonder how much it has to do with the fact that we would have some questions that would be hard to answer.
Well, Linda Fairstein has become a best-selling author. What's Elizabeth Lederer, who was the lead prosecutor, doing these days?
She continues to work for the Manhattan DA's office.
There's police footage of the crime scene. Were you able to obtain that for the film?
The footage, you know, it was such a widely covered story. I think a lot of the local media descended on the scene, and it's still in the archives. In fact, a lot of it was found at the National Network Archives because it had been handed up from the local to the national. Jennings covered it. Tom Brokaw covered it, and so they still had possession of this.
Now, Raymond, do you hope this film will finally clear your name and make people understand what happened to you?
Yes, I really do. I hope that people walk away with the lessons of not being so quick to judge and to rush to judgment, and also, you know, talk to their kids about, you know, the policies and procedures with the police, because as we have stop and frisk, which, you know, is, 800,000 plus, and we know that that's not all criminals, and so there's potentially a Central Park 5 in there somewhere.
Now, I have, Sarah, you've written a book about this case called The Central Park 5, A Chronicle of City Wilding, that was published last year, and you were on our show to talk about it. Since then, we've had a number of other people who have been exonerated, crimes that they didn't commit. And yet, when you look at our listeners' comments, they all, not all, but some people insist that we are wrong and those people still were guilty. And I'm sure that we'll get a few of those from this story as well. Why do you think people continue to hold on to those scenarios?
Well, I think that often has to do with race. I think there was a sense that, you know, part of what made it so easy for people to believe that the Central Park Five had committed this crime had to do with the fact that they were minority teenagers.
But so was Matthias Reyes.
Right. But that doesn't, I mean, that's sort of irrelevant in terms of what people thought at the time about this case. And I think that it's hard to let go of that. It was this really deep-seated assumptions that they were making about these kids that they can't let go of. Even if they sometimes admit that these guys didn't commit this crime, they dismiss it saying, oh, well, they were up to no good. And so what they deserved, whatever happened to them, which is an outrageous statement to make.
17 years. Thank you all so much for being on our show. Raymond Santana, who's one of the Central Park Five, subject of a new film called The Central Park Five that was produced, written, and directed by Sarah Burns, David McMahon, and Ken Burns. It's now showing at the IFC Center and the Lincoln Plaza and will be available on demand in a couple of days, December 7th, so you can watch it on television as well. Thank you all so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.